see if this is working all right. It looks like it is, and think sure.
Well, let's, before we start recording, let's get a picture of what type of stuff you want.
All right. Let me just check something here.
In other words, I looked at that outline, and that's easy.
Well, that's basically what I would like to do. I'm just going to ask you some questions, and you can respond. And
well, let's try a few of the questions before we start recording. So get my line ordered.
Well, I'm going to edit this, and I'll cut out all kinds of things.
Okay.
I just don't want to miss something. So I'm going to send you a transcript, but I will edit the transcript.
Well, whatever you write, do it. I'm a poor editor, and I am a great believer in a man's work's a man's work.
Well, I appreciate that. Why don't... there's just one other thing I needed to...
Well, you go ahead and do what you want. I'll answer any questions.
Okay. I just wanted to get one other thing out of the file.
The only thing I didn't quite understand was, I think it was question number 6 about the award. Well, I don't believe you earned those. In the sense, I don't think you sit out and say, I'm going to win that. You work.
Mm-hmm.
And then your peers decide whether you get something.
Right.
And in this connection, I've been very, very lucky. I'm an extremely lucky man. I've had good men. Now, the other thing that bothers me about something like this is that I don't know where to start. Let me say this. I started work, and the first thing I know or found out was I went to DuPont, and I got there and I found that there were a lot of us, and I found that the boss man liked to call everybody Dr. So-and-so, and I said to myself one day after being there about 2 weeks, that's not for me. Here, doctors are 2 cents a dozen. And so in Illinois, I had been christened Butch. And we had a lot of Illinois men at DuPont at that time at the experimental station. And so nobody ever called me anything but Butch. And Dr. Tamberg, who was the head of the station, and called me one day and says, we don't like that. We don't think that's dignified enough. Well, I said, Doc, let's get it straight. Nobody will remember me except this Butch. So he said, okay, I'll give you one more story. My wife knew Dr. Tamberg. So after he'd been there a little while, and she knew that he didn't like the name, we went there to dinner. And at dinner, everything went fine. She says they ate and they ate and this and that. And finally we were standing at the door and I was talking. And she says, come on, Butch, let's go home. And Tamberg called me in the next day and says, well, I guess there's no use of trying to change it. That's it.
That's great.
And I think that that's been one of my greatest assets. I really do. The other thing I want to make sure we can understand before we get started is that I was nothing without good men. It's people. And by people, I mean all kinds of people. Secretaries, dishwashers, whatever they are important in a team operation. Sure, somebody has to be a part of the team and that. And even who gets a patent is kind of a roll of the dice. And so I hate to... I want you to understand that anything I say is basically in part what the team did. and not me. Because that's so important. And then just one more thing to orient you. Roger Adams was my greatest friend and advisor. I got in Illinois by the roll of the dice. I applied for it, and according to the stories that went around, they were reviewing the people that were going to get in, and the chief came to mind, looked at it and says, "We're not going to let this guy in." Somebody says, "Why not?" He says, "Hell, that's a school of pill rollers." Somebody who, I don't know, said, "Well, look at his grades." And he did, and they were good. And he says, "All right, give him a chance." So that's why he got in Illinois. And that's what I mean, I was lucky. And yet, when I left, and as long as he lived, he was my greatest friend. And many of the things that I did were the results of conversations with the chief. And just to orient one of your questions is, why did I change jobs? Well, I went to DuPont. It did very well, and I was lucky. We'll come to that as we go ahead. But the war started. And when it started, there was a German company, GAF, and they were looking for somebody. And they went to the chief and talked to him. And he came to DuPont one day and says, "Butch, you want that job?" I said, "I don't know." Well, he says, "Let me tell you." He says, "Chemistry, there's no doubt you can do it. But," he says, "what we don't know is how you can manage people in the management." And he said, "At your age, there won't be many chances. But you can get this job, why don't you take it?" So I took it. And that's how I left DuPont. And that's been characteristic of most of the things I've been involved in. And we can go into any of them you want. But that's what made my life. With that kind of a background, you're the boss.
Okay, well, let's go back to, or let me indicate first, today's March 15th, 1995, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Butch Hanford, if I can call you Butch, in his home in Bethesda, Maryland. I know you were born on the 9th of December, 1908, in Bristol, Pennsylvania. Could you tell me something about your father and mother and your family background?
Well, my mother, to me, was the greatest woman that ever lived. My father was a Philadelphian and came from, in quote, of the 1900s, an aristocratic family. My mother came from, in quote, an aristocratic family in Bristol. They were married in Bristol. My father was a bookkeeper, and like all bookkeepers, a beautiful penman. But he couldn't do much because, as an early man, he lifted the bag and had a rupture. And in those days, that meant you would have capacity. The net result was that my mother, who was practically born with a silver spring bone, took over. And she ran everything. And she's the hardest worker that ever lived. No job was too menial for her, as long as she got paid. And there were three of us. I was the middle one. My oldest brother was 2 years older, and my youngest brother was 2 years. And she raised us. During the war, the World War, she ran a dining room of 50 people by herself, people like me. I carried the dishes out at the dining room. And that's the way she lived. She's a very religious woman and read us that way. So she was great. I think, trying to think of one of the things that I think were my assets was, I never had too much money. The net result is that my whole life has depended on slight modifications. I was a student. I was a student who didn't know what to do. Had no money. But on the other hand, I never wanted for anything. But we were told not to want too much. Well, I graduated from Bristol High School. I was no star. I was a good student, but not par excellence. When I graduated from that, I decided I wanted to go to college. And my uncle was a druggist and a graduate of the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Science. He thought it was a great school. And in that 1926, they had just started a new division in chemistry. And he told me that I could go there. If I wanted to go to college, I'd go there and he'd pay my way. That was in Philadelphia. I said, okay, that's a good deal. So he was a power in the school. He had been very successful. And he got me in. And I went to school there.
Had you had any science in high school?
Yes, I did. I had a science teacher by the name of Mr. Snyder, who was a graduate of Muhlenberg College, and he taught chemistry. He was a good teacher. I also had another teacher who was also from Muhlenberg, the one that really got me interested in science was my uncle and Snyder. Now, we had in Bristol, as you probably know, a chemical business, which was Roman Haas. And therefore, we were a little bit acquainted with that. But I was not a tinkler or anything like that as a chemist. But anyhow, I did like it, and Snyder was a promoter, and my uncle thought that was a good job and I ought to take it because of Roman Haas. The net result was that I did go there. I commuted by train between Bristol and Philadelphia and then walked to Penn Street where the school was. The class was very small. I think it had 7 people in it. That's all. We were all of them, all the students had a pharmacy background in the sense that their parents ran a drugstore or something like that. Well, anyhow, I went there and I the thing was that the chemistry I was taught at PCP was very, very experimental and very basic. No fancy pants stuff. We had a very good teacher who had been in the pharmacy for a long while, and the teachers were sound, but they were not I use the word fancy pants. I went there and I did well. I graduated, I don't know if it was the top of the class, it doesn't make any difference, I had good grades. And when I graduated in 1930, I had to find a job. And again, my uncle said, well, if you can't find a job, I'll help you. So that was fine. I applied to some schools, and just about this time of the year, Roman Haas had an analytical chemist that had died, a young man. And he called up my uncle and says, Asa, I know you got a son or nephew who's a chemist, and I wanted to tell you, we got an opening. If he's interested and you are, send him down, we'll talk to him. Uncle Ace says, well, there it is. You go down there. And that was within a few miles of my home. Excuse me. So I went down there, met the superintendent, And he said, okay, you're a chemist. He said, yeah. I said, well, that's all right. Never heard of the school. Well, yeah, it's all right. But he says, the vice president is here of Roman Haas, Dr. Hollinger. And we don't hire anybody without him talking to you. So he says, he's waiting for you. So he took me across the road and into his office, and he pulled up a chair and sat there, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I stayed there 3 hours, and I took the most difficult chemistry exam I ever took. He was an old chemist, and as such, he believed in chemistry is chemistry. And he asked me a lot of questions. I knew the answers of it all except two. I didn't know an insoluble salt of potassium, nor did I know an insoluble salt of sodium. I didn't recall either one of them. But of the results of the net of the 3 hours, that's the only questions I couldn't answer, to his satisfaction. So he stood up, shook hands, he says, you're hired. So that's how I got the job. I went to work in Roman Haas Analytical Laboratory. At that time, Bristol was one of the research areas for Roman Haas. The other was in Bridesburg. And we had in the company at that place a number of PhDs all over the country. And they were working mainly on insecticides. So the laboratory was routine and research samples. Well, we had a fellow that had been there a long time, and he was more experienced than I, but he didn't like to do the experimental section because it always different. So I started to do that. And as a result of being there for about 6 or 8 months, I decided this is not for me. I want to go elsewhere. So these fellows that were all graduates of Illinois and Penn State and places like that, they said, well, you want to go to Penn State? You want to go with me? So I said, well, I'll see. So again, I talked to my uncle and I said, well, I'm going to go to graduate school. Well, he said, go ahead. He didn't make it. So I applied to selling schools. Illinois was one. Penn State was another one in those days. And I had good contacts in those. And I knew F.C. Whitmore he was a consultant for Roman Haas.
Okay.
So I knew him. Well, anyhow, I applied and I was accepted temporarily at Illinois and Penn State. And in the Roman Haas laboratory at that time, there were one from Penn State and there was one from Illinois. And the Illinois fellow says, look, you don't want to go to Penn State. All you do there is distill. That's all that's happening in Penn State now. They give you a still and distill. So you want to learn chemistry, go to Illinois. So it was on that basis a lot that I decided to go to Illinois. So I packed up my clothes and I went to Illinois, and I had no scholarship, no nothing.
This was the Depression.
I just went there. I paid my tuition at the grand total of $75 in those days, which may not be much money even then, but it was a lot of the money to me. But my mother bought my ticket to Illinois, and they agreed to send me some money for my room and board while I was there. So I went and I matriculated and started like, and in the first year I didn't do anything, and I'd been there a little while when the question came up, who are you going to do your work under? And I said, well, I'd like to work for the chief, if you'll have me. So I went down and see him, and he says, that's all right. You work? I said, sure. Okay. So he gave me a problem, and I went to work on it. Well, again, going back to the fact that the money was not very plentiful, there was nothing to do but work in the lab. So I worked 7 days a week in the lab, 15 hours a day. There was no trouble. And in those days, the chief came to see you. He came around the building, and he dropped in at odd times. And no matter when he was there, I was there. And so he gave me a problem, and it was relatively easy. I somewhat solved it. And in about the first year, I had enough for my PhD degree, but that was not enough. And so I'd go down and say, how about a scholarship or something? Nah, which you can make it $75 a semester. You don't need any more than that. So he never gave me an assistantship. He says, you're going to work in the laboratory. And so after I completed the first problem, the chief would travel all over the country, and he'd hear all kinds of problems, and he'd bring them back, and he'd give them to me. Oh, piece of wood or something, see what you could extract from this, and all this kind of junk I did, and I did them for him. And this gave me a tremendous breadth of operation, because I was in all kinds of stuff. And I had a good in with him, and we made out fine. And a typical example of that period was Illinois had a pretty good football team one year. And we wanted to get a radio in the lab. So there weren't any. So the question came up, let's get a radio. Illinois is playing a big game, and we'd like to go. And he said, well, you can down and ask the chief. So I get down, and Mrs. Evans, who was the secretary, was a very good friend of mine. She says, what do you want? I told her, she said, well, you go talk to the chief. So I did. And he thought a minute. He says, okay, one condition, Butch. What's that? That you continue to work while it's on. So I said, fine. I got the laboratory, told the boys, and just in the middle of the game, it was very exciting. Who walks in but Roger Adams? The whole group of people around. But fortunately, I was at the lab. I was working. And he looked there and okay, Butch. We talked about the problem. He kidded the rest of them and went out. And that was Illinois. That's the type of work I did and things.
Did you interact with Carl Marvel at all?
Oh, yeah. Marvel's, I had laboratory. His lab was open. I knew all of them. Because I was a good student. And I did a lot of experimental work. And one of the things that I mentioned to you that I still thought was very important was people. So I made a Marvel, one of my friends. In fact, I finally came to the conclusion that Marvel was the one that said, let's give him a chance. But anyhow, Speed Marvel, Fuson, and all those, I knew very, very well. And knew them all personally as Speed and Butch and Shriner and the rest of them. And I circulated it through all the laboratories, and I knew what most of the people were working on. And it wasn't unusual that somebody would come to me and say, Butch, how do you do this? Well, anyhow, finally, I graduated. And the question was, where do I go to work?
That was 1935.
1935, yes. I had one problem, too, that was then. I was probably and am the poorest linguist that ever lived. But in those days, as you know, a PhD required a reasonable knowledge of French and German. I had practically no German, one semester at PCP and high school French. I knew none. I was terrible. And the chief would come in and says, Butch, when are you going to take them damn languages there? You can't get out of here without them. So I said, okay, and I started. And I learned both French and German in a Butch's way. I had a French chemistry book there and a translation of it over here. I would look at this and then I would look at that. I would look at this and look at that, look at this and look at that. So I had a memory word. I couldn't pronounce anything. I didn't know any structure, but I could get the sense of what it was. So Adam says, "You ready?" I said, "Sure, let's go." In those days in Illinois, it took three passages, one without a dictionary in the language, one with a dictionary in the language, and one in a popular form. So you had three things to translate. So I get that, and I got them, and I pass. But that has always been one of my bugaboos. But my wife used to kid me because I met her in Wilmington, and I married her in Wilmington. And I always had chemistry with me. So we'd sit on the porch, and I'd have a chemistry book, and it was in German. And she says, "How the hell can you read that?" I said, "Don't worry about it. I know what it's about." Well, it so happens that the friend I got the medal or the award from the Inventors Hall of Fame was Don Holmes, who was a classmate of mine in Illinois. That's how we got together. And Don's father was a vice president of DuPont. Don never should have been a chemist, but his father wanted to be one. And Don was a very, very smart fellow. He was a graduate of Amherst, and he was really smart. Languages and all that, he was smart. But anyhow, he and I became good friends, and I met my wife through him, and that's where that came out. But Don used to say, "Well, what are we going to do?" And so that's where how I met them. Now, when I got to DuPont, I was assigned to work for a man by the name of Paul Salzberg.
It was Holmes who got you to DuPont then?
Huh?
It was Holmes who got you to DuPont?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Had you thought about going back to Roman Haas?
No.
Okay.
Never was. I was offered a job at Roman Haas, but again, Adams said, "DuPont." And Adams, I went. And he says, "In DuPont, you go to the experimental station. I'll take care of that, but you'll go into the experimental station. Bolton and I were classmates at Harvard, and you'll be there." So I went. And again, how things played in the way was, I walked into Paul Salzberg's office one morning as I went to work, and he go ahead, you want to do something?
No, I'm right.
He said to me, "Butch, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, I don't care what to do. I'm a chemist." Well, he says, "I got a problem. We have just developed a commercial method for making long chain amines by the nitration, hydrogenation of the nitrile and ammonia." And he says, "So we've got some long chain amines." Now he says, "You probably know that Roman Haas made a job out of the long chain thiocyanates as an insecticide." I said, "Yeah, I analyzed hundreds of them." So he says, "Well, I want the isothiocyanate." He says, "I don't know whether it'll work or not, but," he says, "I don't feel comfortable without it." Now, he said, "I had two men that had worked on it, and I knew them both. They were good friends of mine." And he says, "But they couldn't make it. Do you think you could make it?" I said, "Sure." Well, he said, "That's your problem. And then it'll give you a chance to meet the people and do all of this." And then he says, "One other thing I want to tell you." He says, "I don't want to ever hear you wrote a paper longhand." He says, "Here, we don't do that. You start tomorrow to dictate, and you don't give up." I said, "I never did it, sir." He said, "I didn't ask you that. I told you."